perspective and policy for Ukraine post-war recovery? What should be done after the Russian aggression is over? I have to say that when we discussed it with Professor Balcerowicz, we were planning at that moment to focus mostly on the Western contribution to the future reconstruction of Ukraine. But Professor Balcerowicz, the father of Polish reforms, said something which was very formative for us, very important. Let us focus on policies. What should be done? What Ukrainians themselves should maybe try to do in order to improve their economic situation? And we finally, with the Rector for Research, Vice Rector for Research of the SGH Warsaw School of Economics, Professor Agnieszka Kłoń-Dominczak, will be moderating this debate, going to this direction. Let me just share with you some details regarding how this meeting would be organized, and then I will give the honors of welcoming you all to Vice Rector for Research, Professor Agnieszka Kłoń-Dominczak. This debate is transmitted and available on our YouTube channel. Those followers and users who are there might ask questions as well and put the comments. We will try to follow them and we will communicate those questions to the moderator by the end. Today's debate would be somehow annexed, it would be enriched by tomorrow's presentation of the recent book by Professor Sergei Guriev, the provost of Sciences Po, the leading institution of Civica Alliance, the SGH Warsaw School of Economics is a member of. And this book is on spin dictators, would be the Polish version of this book, at tomorrow at 5 o'clock in the Spado auditorium, which means the spazio, the main patio of SGH, would be this presentation be done, and professor will sign also those copies of the books. Now I will give the floor to Professor Agnieszka Kłoń-Dominczak, who will also introduce our guest. Let me only express my sorrow that Professor Leszek Balcerowicz happens to be ill and unable to join us for this meeting. Wishing him a very fast recovery, we are just welcoming here Jan Hagemeyer from CASE Center for Social and Economic Research, which this organization is our partner in organizing today's debate on perspective and policy for Ukraine's post-war economy. Professor Kłoń-Dominczak, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, and I am extremely honored and privileged to lead this debate, which is indeed on the perspective and policy for the Ukraine post-war economy, which I think we have a really a good set of panelists in this debate that can really discuss what should be done after the Russian aggression is over, but also right now with sometimes not very big, but very small steps in very local communities that are important for people to have hope and to think about what to do in the future, because I think it is the most important. I'm not a macroeconomist, I'm a social policy person more of it. So this is the perspective that I like most, but of course we will discuss the economic perspectives as well. So how our debate is organized. So initially we will ask Dmytro Bojarczuk to present the main findings of the report that was very recently in February published by CASE on the economic priorities of post-war Ukraine, a blueprint for the reform. And that will be the introduction. Okay, we have some copies here, so those of you who are present can definitely benefit from having this in hard copy and read it. And then it will be followed by a debate with very distinguished participants. So we have Professor Sergei Guriev, who is the provost of Sciences Po, but he was also a chief economist of the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. In the past, we have as Mariusz Sielski mentioned, Jan Hagemeyer, who's a director of for macroeconomics and trade. Yes, that's how it should be translated of case, but also a scholar at our sort of partner university in many of the activities, the University of Warsaw. So we are not limited to the Warsaw School of Economics in this discussion. And we also have Professor Timofey Miłowanow, who's the president of the Kiev School of Economics, but apart from being the president of the Kiev School of Economics, he also used to be the Minister of Economy in the Ukrainian government. So we have basically participants who share their, let's say, scholar careers with more macro and more policy-oriented careers as well, which I think is very important for this panel and the debate. So without further ado, I would like to ask Mr. Dmytro Bojarczuk to present the main issues in the report. Yes, I think you can do it from here.
Thank you very much. First of all, I want to thank Warsaw School of Economics for this opportunity, to speak and present in this audience. I will be talking today about report economic priorities in post-war Ukraine. What this report is about, we have developed a high macro level framework for understanding and dealing with Ukraine after the war ends. The report is a multi-layer product, I would say. It covers almost all critical issues related to economic policy. The report is very concentrated. The very initiative came from Polish-American Freedom Foundation. Polish-American Freedom Foundation also was invested financially to this work. The report was produced, drafted by Ukrainian experts, really strong Ukrainian experts in their areas of expertise. And it was reviewed by people with recognized names, Dr. Baltirovich, Ivan Miklos, and Anders Oslund, Marek Dombrovsky, and Christopher Hartwell. So, how can I click?
I think you would just say next.
This way? Okay. Okay. We'll start from what Ukraine was from economic perspective before the war. We had good achievements in various areas of life. We had good macro, it was macro stabilization achieved. We had substantial progress with European integration. A remarkable point is related to strengthening institutional capacity of the NBU. Land reform was launched. Timofey Miłowanow was the hero of this story. And decentralization. A lot has been done. We were on the right way, and so slowly, but we have been moving in right direction. What happened after the war started? We have near 1/3 of GDP erased. The last estimate, 29.2% drop in GDP. Damage cost to Ukraine's infrastructure is estimated more than $140 billion. Near 8 million Ukrainians left the country. Fiscal gap is huge. And the war is still raging, and it's not clear when the war might end. So the economy is seriously damaged. At the same time, with the start of the war, we have several opportunities opened. First of all, Ukraine received candidate status for the EU membership. Brand Ukraine is recognized worldwide, and we hope that after the war ends, this brand will help us to sell goods and services to the total world. And opportunity to build back better, but I would say this is the opportunity to build from scratches, because you know that a lot of infrastructure we inherited from Soviet times, and it was not of very good quality, but now it's a chance to create something new, something much better. How to tap this opportunity? And here is probably the most interesting part. The official approach, I would say a mainstream approach, is that we should harmonize our legislation with the EU legislation, and we should find money for rebuilding the country. From the first glance, it looks very simple and very straightforward. The problem is that for European integration, we need first to establish rule of law in the country. As you know, that kind of harmonization of legislation is not the main challenge. The main challenge is to build fundamentals, as people say in the European Commission, and all legislation is a kind of follow-up. So even if you harmonize legislation and your fundamentals are not good enough, it will not count. And a related story to attract funding, both private and public funds, we again need rule of law, good judicial system and law enforcement system. And what we have is rule of law with Ukraine. As you can see from this graph, actually these are data from the World Bank, World Governance Indicators, Index of Rule of Law. You will see that situation with rule of law in Ukraine changed very modestly over the last 30 years. And one more thing I want to draw your attention, that when Poland was implementing their famous reforms in early 90s, the situation with fundamentals was much better than Ukraine has now in 2020. It's a huge challenge for us to face over the upcoming years. One of the points from the report, I will emphasize several points because, as I mentioned, the report is very concentrated. One of the points is that we suggest, first of all, to develop a kind of numerical indicators to measure the progress in these judicial and law enforcement systems. Why so? Western approach to rule of law, to judicial system, is that when you have a problem, you approve a legislation, better legislation, and that's it. Your problem is solved. But what to do if legislation doesn't work? It's a kind of catch-22. Legislation doesn't work. You approve better legislation, but legislation doesn't work. And that's Ukrainian reality. There is a very poor link between legislation and implementation of this legislation into action. That's why we propose to develop more numerical indicators which will give better picture what is going on and what is going wrong. Something similar to these World Bank indicators, but in more details, and it still should be developed. Another priority is simplification. We again talk about rule of law. When your sophisticated legislation is applied to very specific cases, why is this good? Because it takes some, it's more accurate in addressing some specific problems. But this also means that you will have more stories when, for instance, taxpayer and the state will have different views on the same situation. If you have a lot of such stories, and this means that you those parties will need service of judicial system. When judicial system is not very good, you are in a problem. That's why we claim that Ukraine needs simplification to minimize number of cases when the state, in broad sense, might have different view on the same situation as businesses and taxpayers. It's very important direction for the period while rule of law is under construction. We understand that from this point and till some point of success, the rule of law is in progress of creation, but while it is under construction, simplification is very important priority in terms of stimulating economic growth, especially in the area of small and medium enterprises. But simplification is related to small and medium enterprises. What to do with attracting big, large private investments? Large private investments need two things when we talk about Ukraine. First of all, securitization of military risks. And second thing, securitization of relations with the state while this rule of law is under construction. For military risks, the World Bank already suggests some tools, actually MIGA. They already raised some funding, and as far as I know, they have some pilot projects. Maybe not, but that's what I heard. But what about securitizing relations between private investors and the state, mainly law enforcement bodies? We are saying in this case about law enforcement bodies, about prosecutors and other people which can endanger activities of private investors. We claim that these relations should be securitized and even collateralized, if I said this word correctly. And we propose, for instance, to use potentially confiscated Russian assets to collateralizing these relations, because it will not work like a market of of insurance market. For insuring risks, you need a lot of participants to create this pool, to generate funds to make this securitization. In this case, probably you will need some funds already available to stimulate early comers. We are talking about early comers, investors to enter Ukrainian market to be protected on this side. How it might work. We are talking about macro view. It might work in this way. Those funds potentially confiscated from Russia, for sure, they could not be used on any needs except for those which are related to Ukraine reconstruction, to Ukraine rebuilding. And some of them could be used for collateralizing, and in case some prosecutor, regional prosecutor, I don't know what kind of name could be, will cause damage to private foreign investor, and foreign investor prove this case in foreign courts, this damage could be compensated at the expense of those funds. We assume this might serve as initial additional incentive for early comers to Ukrainian market after the war ends. These are, I would say, three key messages. First of all, incentivizing rule of law, judicial system reform. Second, simplification. And third, securitizing relations between the state and the potential private investors. The report also contains many other sections related to public administration reform, anti-corruption. So as I mentioned, it covers almost everything related to economic development. And I want to pay your attention one more time to Russian assets, which are widely discussed. I think that they should be used for three purposes. First of all, to rebuild Ukraine. Secondly, to stimulate, to add additional incentive for Ukrainian authorities to run faster reforms in terms of establishing rule of law. And thirdly, they should help to build momentum, to build some credibility for first comers of first investors which are coming, potentially will be coming to Ukrainian market. That's all for me. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for setting the picture and the most important challenges as far as the processes, the rule of law, the simplification and all the, say, structure setting issues that are important when we think about the reconstruction and the post-war economy and society in Ukraine. So let me right now move to our panelists and have a discussion with a first question. And I suggest that we start from Professor Miłowanow, as he has a hands-on experience and also some successes in reforming already that was mentioned. What should be the... So the first question is, what should be the economic policy of Ukraine after the war is over, or maybe not even after the war is over, because right now there are certain processes that are happening. Ukraine could do, and how the rest of the world could help to sort of do some of the leapfrogging with the activities, with the EU accession, and with the reforms, so that the Ukrainian economy can recover and can bloom after all the events that happened.
Thanks. So first of all, I think we should do recovery now. I don't like the title. It says after the Russian aggression is over. The Russian aggression is never be over with the current political regime. Even if the war stops, the aggression will take other forms. So that's a separate discussion, but Ukraine is going to face existential threat for a while and has been facing that threat. So the thinking that we can do recovery after things come down and somehow it will be back to prior 20, 2022 or prior to 2014, in my view, is an illusion. So it's an attractive illusion. It's an easy to buy into illusion in the EU where there is no war. It's difficult for us to imagine that there are people who just want to destroy other people, but there are. And I recently talked to a journalist from Norway, and he said it's difficult for us to, you know, we remember Breivik, who came and just shot kids for political reasons. And it's still difficult for us to understand and comprehend that, you know, there's no way to negotiate some kind of resolution. Why just people can't simply talk it out, you know? And that was my 2014 perspective, when that's why I started engaging with Ukraine, because I saw the Heavenly Hundred killed in Ukraine by our own police, by the Ukrainian police. So a side box, that's how far Ukraine has gone in this 8-9 years. That in 2014 we had our own law enforcement shooting our students downtown Kyiv. And in 2022 we can resist a fully fledged military invasion by hundreds of thousands of soldiers. So Ukraine is changing quickly, but for me in 2014, it was difficult to comprehend with all my training, understanding, and exposure to Ukraine and the West. Decade or two decades of outside of Ukraine in economics, studying everything from models to history, that we can't just resolve these problems in Ukraine by some kind of better institution building. And I think we can't. Today we're talking about the EU accession and integration and candidacy as the main driving force for the post-war reforms. But let's remember that that's what started 2014, the decision of people of Ukraine to move not towards Russia but to Ukraine. And the war is a consequence of that too. So we can't ignore the war context in trying to build institutions. It's not a separate planet on which we can decide, discuss, and it's not a standard EU project where you have a country which lives in isolated environment and needs to integrate. No, every step towards integration is an escalation from the perspective of the current Russian, you know, current Russia as is. So that has to be thought of very carefully and taken into account. So I would say, after the Russian aggression is over, is a big after. We should talk about reconstruction now. The second point I want to make is that there is this notion of grandeur reconstruction. And people say, you know, we need $500 billion, $750 billion. And for many people, these numbers seem ridiculous. But let's have a little calculation. Ukraine probably is going to lose or has lost at this point 10 million people in some way. You know, by migration, let's say, or by their livelihood taken in economic terms, by being traumatized. Not maybe, you know, let me put $1 million value life on each of them. Okay, in Ukraine before the war, it was 400 estimates of the World Bank, 500. In the US, it would be 10 million, 20 million. Let me put 1 million just to do a rough calculation. Some people will recover, some will not, some will move, some have been killed, you know. 10 million people by $1 million, that's $10 trillion. You do other type of calculations, we have lost 7% of residential housing, which we have accumulated. Some of our housing, some of the better housing downtown Kyiv or Kharkiv, that was built 100 years ago. I own an apartment which was built. It's a good apartment, but it took us decades, if not hundreds of years, to build our housing. We have lost 7%. How much, you know, so $300-500 billion is actually not that outlandish if you start doing proper calculations, whatever angle you want to take. And that's why we're doing damage assessments, because we were at damage assessments using the standard methodologies, I had 143, 138, depending on whether you take the Kyiv School of Economics or the World Bank. But add to that human, environmental, business losses, you will be 300, 400 easily. Okay, so we're going to see a project which will take, if we want to rebuild Ukraine, That's going to take a lot of money. So don't think grandeur because it's scary. No politician will sign off on $100 billion or $500 billion. Do small projects, rebuild a village, and scale up, scale up, scale up. And because we actually cannot think in our standard frameworks, macro frameworks or institutional frameworks about what to do in Ukraine, we have to experiment a lot. We have to do pilots, and we have to assess pilots, and we have to copy what works and move it elsewhere to other domains. Now, of course, we have to continue to do GDP assessment and macroprudential framework and austerity and the IMF program, but we have to take it with skepticism. Because when the numbers, the GDP is down by 30%, what do they measure? When an IT person was taken out from the IT sector, and now he is building a trench, is it an addition or loss to GDP? According to standard economics, it is a loss. But if you are real about this, this person now is saving lives. And that specific fortification actually might protect Ukraine from much more destruction. So the value added of a trench might be much higher in Ukraine than the value added of an IT service, given that the ChatGPT is out there. So finally, so I made 2 points to summarize. One is that start now, not later. And start small, not grandeur. But good economics is always bad politics. And good politics is often, if not always, bad economics. So we should not ignore what will happen after the war. There'll be the moral authority of people who have fought, and they will be the leaders. I'm actually quite optimistic about this because there's this discussion that, oh, you know, these people will be radicalized and the civil society, actually have heard that phrase. The civil society in Kyiv or elsewhere is the only one which has the hope for the future of Ukraine. No, the civil society is at the front. The civil society is fighting now and defending its country. So in that sense, we need to think about what this civil society as a form or as a notion, what form it will take after the war, who will be the leaders in Ukraine, and incorporate that in our thinking about how to build institutions and integrate with the EU. I posed more questions than answers, of course, but at least I suggested 2 very clear points. Now, not later, small, not grand. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Professor Guriev, what do you think about it?
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me, and it's a great pleasure and honor to be here and speak on the same stage with Jan and Timofey. We advertise this as a debate. I don't think there is a major disagreement between us. And actually, with Timofey, we wrote a few papers together on the subject. What we did, we produced a report which is similar in spirit to what Dmytro has presented. Again, nothing to disagree about. When the war started, when the 2022 full-scale war started, Timofey and another Ukrainian economist, Yuri Gorodnichenko, came up with this idea to write a paper about reconstruction. That was very brave because at that point it was not clear at all when and how the war will end, and we were fortunate enough to assemble a team. Eventually, that was the first rapid response economics paper of CEPR, Center for Economic Policy Research, with Timofey, Yuri, and 5 other Western economists, we put together this blueprint for reconstruction in Ukraine. Later on, the same team produced another paper on macroeconomics of wartime Ukraine in August 2022, and then in the fall, under leadership of Yuri, but with the important participation of Timofey, a group of authors produced a whole book of 500 pages, again, under auspices of CEPR, detailing reform area by reform area, what Ukraine should do to prosper. And this is the short answer to any question about recovery and reconstruction of Ukraine is please read this book. We presented this book a couple of months ago in Paris, and then you represented also it's in Brussels. Timofey's chapter is actually a chapter on the governance and anti-corruption reforms. I'll mention that in a second. This is most important chapter, chapter two of this book, written together with Gerard Roland from Berkeley. But let me just say a few important things which we identified already when we were writing this report in March 2022 in this first paper, Blueprint for Reconstruction in Ukraine, for Ukraine, which was published on April 8 by CPR. So what we were talking about, we were saying that with all the uncertainty about post-war reconstruction or during the war reconstruction, we need to agree on certain principles, and these were the principles I still think are completely valid. So what were these principles? First and foremost, reconstruction should start as soon as possible. We identified several stages of reconstruction, and we were talking about the first stage, stage zero, we called it, should start as soon as possible. We also talked about how aid should be rapid but conditional. We talked about how aid should come from outside but be owned by Ukraine, and what the mechanisms should be to make sure that outside external aid would actually hit the needs of Ukrainian society. And we talked about how decentralized ownership by local authorities and matching funds would actually guide external aid towards the needs, the most urgent needs, things that Timofey was talking about. Today, deoccupied villages, each of them having their own needs, and people from Washington would be, or Brussels would be able to listen to the needs on the ground. Another issue was, of course, that we shouldn't be naive, and reconstruction should be based on grants rather than loans. A lot of financial aid which came in 2022 and continues to come in 2023 takes the shape of loans. We should not deceive ourselves. Unfortunately, a lot of those loans will not be repaid. They will have to be restructured. The damage to Ukrainian economy, as Dmytro was talking about, is unprecedented. So the decline in GDP, the debt burden, or the budget deficits in 2022 were too important to imagine that most of these loans will be repaid. We talked a lot in this report about EU integration before actually Ukraine got an EU status, and we talked about how EU integration will help to guide and coordinate the reforms, to coordinate expectations and priorities for reforms. In Dmytro's report, he talks about how the candidate status actually provided a set of reforms, a set of requirements for Ukraine, including on governance, anti-corruption, rule of law, de-oligarchization, and so on and so forth. EU has been very clear that these are the conditions that are needed for Ukraine to become a member, which Ukraine itself needs to become a prosperous and just society. And this is good that this membership process has clearly identified those dimensions of reform. And these dimensions of reform are critical for successful reconstruction, because whatever amounts of money are coming in, it's important that they are used effectively. And Ukraine, with all its challenges in rule of law and corruption and oligarch's role in the economy, will be able to use those funds effectively. So one of the things we discussed was the coordination of aid, and we propose a specialized agency that would direct those funds. Now, this is one of the big challenges of reconstruction, and this is actually where Timofey's chapter in that book that was recently published is very detailed. So Timofey and Gerard talk about how this agency will be structured, what the role of this agency is going to be, how this agency will contribute not only at the stage of reconstruction, but also provide human capital for Ukrainian civil service later on, And so as somebody who worked at EBRD, you mentioned that I worked at EBRD, I also have been part of this process, which we call the Ukraine Reform Architecture, where we also tried to do that after 2014 war, but before 2022 war. And many of these efforts paid off. There are certain parts of civil service in Ukraine which are really world-class right now. And this work should continue, and part of that is using this idea of the agency. Now, this idea is very controversial. We refer to the agency that was set up during Marshall Plan, that was a U.S. government agency, which played a key role in reconstruction of Europe after World War II. And so this time around, we naturally propose EU-authorized agency. Why is that not obvious? Because we will need funds coming not just from EU, but also from member states, from G7 countries, in particular US, other donors. And so while EU-authorized agency is natural, given Ukraine candidate status, the other donors will have to buy onto this idea. Why is this agency important? Because it should be the port of entry for all international donors. It should coordinate donor efforts. Having this experience of working within international development systems, I would tell you that unfortunately different institutions have different modes of operation, different priorities, and sometimes they compete. And sometimes they try to crowd out each other. Sometimes they cannot coordinate. And so if we have one single port of entry, that will definitely facilitate the aid. And hopefully it will take on. Actually, in May 2022 already, European Commission published a communication on reconstruction of Ukraine. And there they proposed something similar to what we have in mind. They call it a platform, EU-authorized platform. And that's actually great that this idea is taking root. Now, what else will have to be done? Well, the main question, and Dmytro touched on this, is where the money is coming from. And Timofey was talking about numbers. Kyiv School of Economics actually documents all the destruction of physical assets. Timofey correctly identified that the main loss is human loss, the loss of human capital. But there is also a register of all the physical capital being destroyed, and Kyiv School of Economics at this stage, I think, has counted on $144 billion just of physical capital. And so this is a number which is part of the overall assessment by the World Bank, which has recently identified more than $400 billion needs for reconstruction of Ukraine. Is that impossible? Well, we are in an unprecedented situation. And when we think about how much, say, the Marshall Plan has cost U.S. Government, U.S. government has spent in current dollars something like $170 billion. It's a lot of money, but it's a comparable magnitude. And finally, we have the Russian frozen assets. Now, one thing which I would tell you is whatever Russian government says, Russian government, Russian society have accepted this idea that Russian government will never see those assets anymore. There are some private players who still think that they will get their private assets back. That's a different issue. But Russian government has announced that Russian central bank's assets worth of about $300 billion have been frozen. And I think everybody's accepted the idea that this money will be eventually taken over by the West, which will use it to compensate, to pay for Ukrainian infrastructure reinvestment and recovery. So how legally it's going to happen, this is a different question. But one of the things I would mention is, even if legally today it's hard to expropriate those assets, Dmytro's proposition is completely plausible, where Ukraine sues Russia, and in the process, all the donors will bet on understanding that this lawsuit will be resolved in Ukraine's favor, and Ukraine will eventually get a court warrant. I still don't know which court, I still don't know in which instance Ukraine will sue Russia, but in some international court, Ukraine will sue Russia, will win, and will get a court warrant for whatever, $400 or $500 or $300 billion. And with this court warrant, Ukraine will be able to ask Russia to pay. If Mr. Putin is still there, he will say no. And so Ukraine will be able to seize all this $300 billion and whatever other assets the West will be able to identify. And so this money will be used for reconstruction of Ukraine. When Mr. Putin is finally gone, there'll be other ways to pay for Ukraine's destruction by Russian troops. I'll give you an example, which we also use in our paper, which is Iraq and Kuwait. After invasion of Iraq, United Nations forced Iraq to pay a share of its oil revenues, and that's been done for 30 years. So for 30 years, Iraq has been paying, and this was completed literally a couple of years ago. Iraq was paying to Kuwait a share of its oil revenues, paying for destruction Iraq's invasion caused Kuwait. Again, Mr. Putin will say no, but post-Putin government will agree to that. One of the things that is now in the public domain is all anti-Putin Russian opposition groups have agreed in writing, in public, to the fact that we need victory of Ukraine. And victory of Ukraine for us, it's not just restoring territorial integrity back to 1991 borders. It's not just sending war criminals to international tribunals, but also paying reparations. And so in that sense, I think for me, it's absolutely clear that at least today's level of destruction, for that, Russia will be able to pay no matter what. Well, for some of those amounts, we need to get rid of Mr. Putin. That's a different story. But here I agree with Timofey. Unfortunately, we will need to do that anyway, because as long as Mr. Putin stays in the Kremlin, the war will continue in whatever form. And I just wanted to say that however big these numbers are, they're completely feasible. And in that sense, however horrible the situation on the ground is today, I think there are many, many reasons to think that Ukraine will reemerge of this and being reconstructed like many parts of Europe. And this city, Warsaw, where we are now in, have been rebuilt. And this is final point that I would refer to our paper and to the book. We talk a lot about building back better. This is Ukraine now is in a horrible state, but when we rebuild, we don't need to rebuild a reasonably polluting economy, which Ukraine was before the war. We will build a much greener, much more innovative, much better connected Ukrainian economy, using modern technology, using new principles, using new urbanization blueprints. And in that sense, that's also something that I think is a reason for optimism. And on this note, let me thank you again.
Thank you very much. Indeed, as you have mentioned, Poland has some experiences in rebuilding the economy in far-fetching reforms, and Professor Balcerowicz was indeed one of the people behind one of the most challenging and difficult reforms that were implemented right after the transition. We all discussed very high inflation in Europe that we have. I checked the numbers in 1991. We had 526% of inflation that was put down to reasonable numbers within just a few years. And this is one of the examples of the successes of the reforms of that time that happened in Poland and that paved the way to the EU accession. The question is how we can share our experiences with the situation, which is of course different than what we have in Poland, we had in Poland back at the early 1990s, but still some of the processes and some of the challenges probably could serve as a basis of the experiences and how can we help and to meet the challenges and the issues that were mentioned. Jan?
Of course, the situation of Ukraine is vastly different from the one of Poland in 1990 or 1989. First of all, because there is a war going on that's taking place in a substantial part of the country and leading to substantial losses of human capital mainly and physical capital as well. But I think that unlike in the 90s in Ukraine, right now the situation is sort of converging to one that we had in the 90s, in a sense that in terms of the support of the Ukrainian society for orientation towards the West rather than the East. And in the case of Poland, and actually not only Poland, but also countries that started from a very low economic and social development level, like Bulgaria and Romania, this social support that was meant, that was what was connected with the prospective accession to the EU, but also the commitment to the future accession to the EU was a commitment device that forced the politicians and also the society to accept a set of reforms. Which, I mean, if you look at the experiences of the countries that acceded to the EU and their comparators, none of the countries that have not acceded actually achieved a comparable level of economic development. So, I mean, of course, on top of the things that Dmytro said already, and was said before, where you have these largest disadvantage of the Ukrainian economy, which is the lack of functioning rule of law, which is, I would say, a prerequisite to start doing anything. Because this warrants foreign direct investments, foreign relations with Ukrainian enterprises, and so on and so on. What the policies could do at the moment, which would be again something similar to what happened in the early and mid 90s with the association agreements of the acceding countries, was outward of orientation of the Ukrainian business. In particular, Dmitry said something about the harmonization of Ukrainian law towards EU law, and I mean, of course, there are areas where it, you know, this is difficult, but there are areas when it's actually quite important to do, and that will very quickly increase the opportunities for the Ukrainian enterprises. This is in particular if you consider, you know, the standards and technical regulations that govern the access to markets in Ukraine, if they are harmonized with the EU legislation as quickly as possible, in particular for the agricultural sector, for example, then it means, you know, a lot of increased access to the EU markets. And then, you know, the problem is, of course, that if you think about the Ukrainian society right now, they are very much determined to join the EU. But they are also, I mean, subjected to a huge strain because of the war going on, because of the cost of reforms that are going on as well. So, I mean, in every of those countries, there was the countries that I refer to, the acceding countries, you know, the support to integration was slightly fading out in time before the actual integration because of all these reforms. So it's actually very important that to use this window of opportunity as quickly as possible in order to introduce as many reforms as possible, in order to make sure that the benefits of future EU integration come as quickly as possible. To at least to some extent to outweigh the effects of the war. And of course, I mean, Timofey said a lot about the costs of the war and, you know, the opportunity cost of, you know, putting people on the front instead of putting people in the economy that actually provides income. But I mean, both of these parts of the economy are important because you are funding the war in a way. I mean, you get a lot of support from the external partners, but I mean, this one is not going to be endless as well, right? So you need to reconstruct whenever, wherever you can, through these reforms and through outward orientation of the economy. Just as the last part, I think that if we think about Ukraine, I mean, at least you know from the European perspective, we regard Ukraine as a country that's on one hand a large agricultural and food producer, and then also there is quite a bit of heavy industry there. But in fact, if you look at the data, then you know the level of human capital, I mean, of course, right now it's falling due to these unfortunate circumstances, but it's quite high relatively to, let's say, the level of physical capital and so on. And there is a lot of small and medium enterprises. And I think that also in the sectors like IT, all of those modern sectors, right? And these are the sectors that could be the, I would say, the vehicle that could in fact provide a lot of growth opportunities for the sector, in particular if you consider whatever the free trade area with the EU is already putting in place, and it's not utilized a lot so far. Just as a last point, this is also important for the EU. As you know, there are a lot of processes going on that, so to say, bring back the manufacturing processes and also the supporting services to Europe and to the nearest neighborhood of Europe because of changes in the global scene, deterioration of economic relations with Russia, of course, but also China. And there is a lot of industry and supporting services in Europe that is waiting to be located in Ukraine, as this is going to provide a lot of unutilized opportunities for growth, better factor allocation, and so on. So I think that's the place where the reconstruction and reform should be obvious. Thanks.
Thank you. Let me move a little bit to the question how to, first, what are the most important negative developments or trends that basically should be eliminated to have those reforms a success? And we discussed a little bit before this debate that it is very important to think about the ownership. Once I attended a seminar a long time ago, and there was a lady who said, let me cite, you know, consultants are like crocodiles. They have big mouth, they talk a lot, but there's nothing behind. So the question is, what to do to avoid the crocodile? So that there are many people that come and say, we have a brilliant idea what to do in Ukraine. And there's another person that comes, we have another brilliant idea what to do. But the question is, as Timofey said, that it is important that really people in Ukraine have the ownership, they lead the process with the support of those people that are there to support, to provide resources, to provide the knowledge, the know-how. But it is indeed important to have this process being owned and being steered by those people that know what is the best and not the crocodiles that are around and really would like to seize the opportunity. Timofey?
I was hoping you will not direct it to me. But we have written with Sergei this and with Yuri and with everyone else, and we have been arguing exactly about this importance of ownership. I'm now convinced that ownership has to be done at all levels. So people in a village have to own their reconstruction. People in a city have to own their reconstruction. And people in the country have to own their reconstruction. So to me, it's a much more permeating process which you know, it's very different from what most people have in mind when they talk about ownership. Will it be that it is some institution in Washington or Brussels owns it and issues, you know, directives or delegates to contractors and they hire consultants, and or will it be a bureaucrat at, you know, in an office in Kyiv? Neither of that I call ownership. And I think the real ownership is that people rebuild their communities and rebuild their economies. They prioritize and they are given capacity. So the old idea of capacity, support, or building is great. But somehow in the process, it often gets subverted into, instead of capacity building, imposition of our, you know, priorities, coming sometimes from averages over different countries. I remember being in a negotiation with the IMF several years ago as the minister, where people were talking about a specific issue, and the person was from a desk using some experience in some other country and was basically copying the policy completely, which is sometimes is fine if you understand the first principles. But if you don't understand the first principles and go in details and copy the details, then it becomes a problem. So I think the best way to avoid it is first to open offices in Kyiv for the IFIs. They're still debating. A year into the war, after every president and prime minister and politician in the world has been to Kyiv, they're still debating whether they should have permanent presence. And even in those, among those embassies, not even IFIs, embassies, which are present there, they would have very limited, you know, non-family constraint stuff, and these two guys would have to listen to everything, and by the afternoon, they simply want to get a scotch, so they forget about everything they have heard in the morning, because they're... Yes, I think a drink. They want a drink, not... Yeah, thank you. Whiskey or, you know, anything. They simply want to go to a bar, and because they're informationally overloaded, those two or three guys, because they have to be experts on everything, they have to take notes and report back to Brussels, London, Paris, Washington. Yeah, this is just simply not working. It is not going to work with that amount of capital, human capital capacity. We talk about capacity training, and we're not putting capacity for the IFIs and the embassies themselves. That's ironic. The second one is that these guys have to travel regions. It's the same argument. It's just expanded outside of Kyiv. Kyiv is not the country per se. And the recovery, of course, it's needed in Kyiv, but it's much more needed where there has been destruction, okay? And it's very heterogeneous. So they have to talk to people. They have to get... People say, oh, you know, we have data. It is true, but the data is collected by people who are there. And priority decisions are still being made about which data is collected, which is not. And I think coming back to the discussion we just had before the meeting, alignment is very important. People simply getting together and talking without presumptions, without this intellectual arrogance. You know, every camp has their own ideological idea about. Just, you know, slow down, back off, open your eyes, you know, put some, you know, flexibility in the way you think about it. Accept that the ideas could become, you know, this values we cherish about inclusivity and ideas coming from everyone. So let's actually implement them. So this is number two. So open offices, have people talk to each other, and put smart people in place. You put good people in place. Not every country. Some countries obviously have increased the quality of personnel they are putting in Ukraine. Some of the people we have met, they are as good as it gets. But some other countries, for them, it's a punishment post. Those people will not be able to deliver. Okay, so you have to... I just watched on Netflix a show diplomat, and it says there, you know, in the London office, they have shortage on Russian experts because they said all Russians were sent either to Washington or to Kyiv. All Russian experts. That's what should be done, okay? All human capital should be sent either to where decisions are made, you know, one part, or to where decisions are made or information is to the other part. I don't mean Kyiv or Washington, but where the decisions are being, you know, where the information is and decision, not to Kyiv, you know, necessarily. But of course, then there is the issue of governance and corruption. Because Ukraine has two brands. One brand is it's a resilient country, which is brings back the notion of the EU project in many ways, going back to fundamentals, why, given the history of humankind, we want to set up institutions and relationships between the countries which make wars impossible. And it brings back, it's really difficult to believe, but it brings back as vivid as it was when the EU project started. You know, the very same issues are at place. But at the same time, it has the image of corruption and poor governance. And now some of that image I would like to qualify, because we have to separate between corruption perception and actual corruption. Both are there, but corruption perception often, you know, and I think we thank it to the times of Yanukovych and Lazarenko. You know, I asked ChatGPT another time, like list five top Ukrainian corrupt officials and listed Lazarenko, Yanukovych, Tymoshenko was number five, my best friend in politics. She's still suing me for the land market reform years after. But anyway, so I think there is perception and there is a lag. And then there is corruption. But I also think corruption is a little bit like gun violence in the US. The moment we say gun violence, that's it, no discussion anymore. You know, there are people who, you know, the entire society is polarized. There's the debate is over, you know. We're not treating gun violence as a public health problem, and so we're not treating corruption as a public health. Immediately it becomes judgmental and ethical. You know, Ukrainians are bad or Ukrainians are good, you know. And if the Ukrainians are good, they are fighting corruption and these are the bad oligarchs. If Ukrainians are bad, these are corrupt guys who are, okay, fighting Russia, but this is, and this is really counterproductive. Are we talking about corruption when an official, let's say a doctor, a state, you know, they expect a bribe for, or we're talking about an oligarch who captured an anti-monopoly or a politician or someone else and they pass a law in a fully legal way? Or we're talking about corruption when something is off the books to go and finance military intelligence? Yes, it is corruption too. And it is off the books. Because if you're going to put it on the books in the parliament, you will not be able to run the operation. And we're not the US where we have the committees. We don't have that sophisticated system. So we actually have to finance a lot of defense effort through either state-owned companies, some of this is public, or through other sources. You can't put all of it under the word of corruption. You can put it under the world of governance, and then talk about principles, transparency, accountability, and responsibility. And now we're talking about something, because responsibility, someone has to be a leader. Accountability, there should be consequences, and they're probably political. In that way, there are consequences in Ukraine, and people who are corrupt, they face political and sometimes, more recently, legal consequences. But transparency is a problem during the war. And I feel like I'm talking to two camps. One camp says, bring everything to make transparent. The other camp says, nothing can be transparent because it's a war. And both are right. Because the moment there is no transparency, there are elements of corruption. Everywhere. Everywhere. In Ukraine, in the US, in any, you know, probably here, I don't know Poland, but probably people, you know, people try. They should be disciplined. So transparency helps. But we run a KEC Foundation too, and we do humanitarian effort, and we were supplying medical kits in tens of thousands in the beginning of the war. And if the Ministry of Health, the day before they deliver, tells me to divert from Kherson to Poltava, That information per se is not very important, but if I'm doing thousands of these transactions, that information together, even at my foundation, correlates with the tactical situation on the front line. And I think there has been a discussion why Ukraine is reluctant to provide to international organizations data on hospitals and wounded, given that some of those organizations still have Russian government getting data from those organizations, officially, through official channels. I'm not going to name the organizations, but that's a scandal. After, you know, more than a year of war. And then they're saying that we're non-transparent. We're not non-transparent. The moment we provide this information, our enemy will have information about our losses. They will be able to correlate it out, extrapolate it out. So these are really difficult questions that have to be addressed in a very serious manner. How do we maintain transparency and non-transparency at the same time? How do we fight corruption? Because it's a political process. So in that sense, I think we have to address the governance issue and corruption issue to be able to be owners. I also think the project will fail if Ukraine is not the owner, Ukrainian people, I mean by that, not oligarchs, but Ukraine. If it's going to be Ukrainian corrupt officials or Ukrainian oligarchs, or if it's going to be legally correct bureaucrats somewhere in the U.S. taking 50% on a dollar, you know. That will be a problem. All of that will come back and bite. People will be frustrated. There will be regressionary policies, and Russia will take advantage of that on the discontent of people. So we actually have to be very careful about designing ownership and designing transparency. So to wrap it up, to actually get transparency, we went to depoliticize it as much as possible. I believe in civil society, and I think they're extremely important for political future of Ukraine. And at every wrong turn, potentially wrong turn, the civil society of Ukraine has been able to save Ukraine, be it 2004, 1991, 2013, or 2022. But I would rather have an audit company verify the cost of the square meter of a rebuilt hospital rather than politicians or civil society. Because that has to be technocratic. So accountability and transparency, even in the areas where there's not, it's okay to hire a reputable international or Ukrainian audit company and have them privately evaluate the cost of recovery or cost of a building and benchmark it against the market and submit a report at the risk of losing their license that they have not found non-targeted use of funds. We actually, as a foundation, did it in June of this year, six months into the year. We did an audit on making sure that all funds, every cent that we received, has been accounted for. And it was not easy. It was not easy because it was a war, and some people who were supposed to give us documents were killed by that time that we were doing audit. But we did it. The administration, the officers hated it, you know, because it was a nightmare. But we did it. And today we are only one or the one of the only one foundations in Ukraine which has an audit for the first months of the war that we can account for every cent. And I think the same has to be done. Audits. It's going to be extremely difficult. People will say that it's not possible during the war, but it is possible and has to be done. It has to be done in a non-political, objective way. Outside of the system. So bring people to Ukraine, be aware of the ownership throughout the country, understand that otherwise it's a failing proposition, get competent people and move discussion to a technocratic discussion as much as possible, but keep in mind the trade-off between national security and transparency.
Thank you very much. I think these are again very wise words on what to do and how to do it. Could you reflect on that, Sergei?
Well, I fully agree with what Timofey has said, and I would just add that there have been important achievements before 2022 in fighting corruption. Timofey's already indicated Central Bank, National Bank of Ukraine, has has actually built capacity. And when we talk about, for example, when we talk about inflation, there is no doubt that Ukraine has capacity for macroeconomic policy making. It's never been easy. There have been changes in the leadership of the central bank. Timofey himself was in the council, in the board of the bank, of the central bank. But one of the things I would mention, Timofey was talking about the transfer of knowledge. When we were working in the BRD, we thought the transformation of National Bank of Ukraine was so important and so successful that we actually asked one of the former governors of the National Bank to Ukraine to go to other countries, to the Northern African countries, to tell them how to reform central bank. And again, you need to understand first principles, but there was a lot of useful stuff that could be transplanted. The knowledge could be transplanted from Central Bank of Ukraine, National Bank of Ukraine, both in technocratic sense and in governance institutions and anti-corruption sense. So there are many, many achievements there. Another achievement, of course, this is something that we talked about before this session, the procurement system, which has become an important tool for making spending more effective, minimizing corruption in government procurement, but also in privatization of small assets, small government assets. Another success was reform of the natural of the gas and oil company Naftogaz, which was the macroeconomic problem for Ukraine right after 2014. The vast majority of government budget deficit was because of Naftogaz, and then Naftogaz reformed itself and became a much more efficient company. So all these things are doable. There is no genetic predisposition of Ukrainian society of being corrupt. So whatever Timofey was talking about, I fully agree with. These things are doable. The war is not the best time to fight corruption. I fully agree with that. But overall, I remain optimistic on the ownership, of course.
Sorry, Sergey, but also just to add, I think but the motivation is the biggest in some sense. It's difficult in technical terms because of these trade-offs, but people have had enough. And so,
yeah, this is. I fully agree with that. Honestly, that sounded like in 2014 as well, when people said 100 people died in Maidan because they wanted to join Europe and they wanted to fight corruption. And indeed, a lot of success has happened after 2014, but of course motivation will be much stronger now, because it's not 100 people who died, but tens of thousands who've died, and maybe more. So there is a huge cost paid for the will of Ukraine to become a European country and to become a country where corruption is eliminated. So that'll be there. And I would fully support Timofey's call to international financial institutions to establish offices on the ground, not just in Kyiv, but also in other places. I remember when I worked in MBRD, my job as a chief economist was also to explain to others what our mission is and how EBRD is different from other international financial institutions. Every international financial institution is proud of its own modus operandi, structure, mission, and so on. But what we would say is, unlike others, we have offices on the ground because every country is different, every region is different. We want to understand the specificities because we want to have clients and we want to talk to clients, and for that we need to have officers on the ground, and I strongly believe in this model, and I fully support what Timofey has said.
Jan, from perspective of Poland and Polish experiences, and how we can help?
How we can contribute
to this process?
I wanted to say something about the EU experience in distributing the structural funds, which is, I think, one of the ways this could be organized. So, as you know, the EU structural funds, I mean, most of the EU funds that go into, you know, also cohesion funds and so on, they are distributed at the different levels of government in the country where they are allocated, right? And the selection of projects, for example, is mainly the responsibility of the different levels of government. While, of course, there is supervision by the EU, there are audits and so on and so on, so it's more or less transparent. But this way, I mean, the ownership is there. In a way, this is something that could be taken into account when you design the system of absorbing the aid. Also, I mean, I think it's important that Ukraine takes the ownership in a way that, you know, it established the infrastructure for receiving aid in a way. So, I mean, well, we have an institution or a network of institutions that has local presence and so on, and, you know, we talk with the donors and coordinate with them, right? So that's something that that can be done at the Ukrainian level, just to sort of say, want to take one step ahead to address the problems that you have mentioned. And also, I mean, as far as the Polish experience is concerned, I mean, once again, you said that fighting corruption is difficult. Thing in the times of war. Oh, I agree. I mean, there should be probably a very clear division between, you know, the military part of the economy and the non-military part in the economy, where this military part of the economy is, you know, subject to confidential rules. And surely, I mean, you cannot have a public tender for the purchase of tanks or whatever. But I mean, that. At some point, corruption is an obstacle, right? And if you consider the examples of Romania and Bulgaria, where this still, to some extent, is a problem, but it was eradicated to a large extent over the course of EU integration, and it was also one of the key elements of this process. So, I mean, I don't think you can. In a way, say we're going to hold corruption removal indefinitely, because that's actually one of the problems. This is also related to the lack of the recognition of the rule of law and so on, right? It's, I think this is actually one of the most pressing problems in Ukraine. Thanks.
Yes, but I think with the corruption, it is also how we set the mindset of people. Of course, there's a big corruption, as one mentioned, but also understanding that, you know, some processes can be transparent. I remember when I was a child, when I went to the doctor or the dentist, my mom always gave me either a box of chocolates or a pack of coffee or, well, maybe not a bottle of an alcohol, but it was obvious that when you go to the doctor and you're an adult, you should have a bottle of an alcohol.
But somehow it's not anymore.
And I think it's a tremendous achievement that right now when we go to the doctor, it's a civilized process and we don't have to pass this box of chocolates that was perceived as a norm before. So,
first of all, it brings on uncertainty, right? Because you don't really know what is the actual transaction cost.
Exactly.
Anyway, I mean, at any moment of your economic activity, right?
So you know, having removing those small kind of things is important to set the mindset, you know, large. We don't have, I mean, right now Poland buys military things like a lot without really a very developed procurement procedures, because we have a special law to do that. So, you know, we still can have transparency without very long processes and reducing corruption. The issue is of how to do that in a smart way. And I think that's also something that we can share within the process. I think it is important really to be on the side and see not only the big city, but the small village and all the different faces of what is the situation of the societies. As we again discussed before this debate, sometimes the people are very optimistic, though the cities are destroyed or the villages are destroyed. Sometimes they are after a sort of long period of being seized and being occupied. And in such case, the situation is much more difficult. The trauma within the people is much more difficult to overcome. And this is a challenge. Okay, we still have half an hour. So we can open to the questions from the audience. I have one question that was already delivered by the YouTube, and this is a question from Kiev, from Kuba Karnowski, who's there. To all panelists, is the idea of the adopting foreign law, like for example the UK law, for arbitrage disputes between future investors involved in reconstruction and the Ukrainian government realistic? So I will ask our panelists to respond to this question and then open to other questions from the audience.
Well, it is doable. And there is an example of Kazakhstan, which built International Financial Center in Astana. Actually, when Astana was renamed to Nur-Sultan, it remained Astana International Financial Center. Now Astana is renamed back to Astana. It still remains Astana International Financial Center, and there English law is applied. So it's completely doable. I don't think it's needed. I think investors, if they want, can sign agreements enforceable in London. That's completely doable as well, with or without regulations adopted at whatever level. So if two foreign companies, or a foreign and a Ukrainian company, sign an agreement, they can add a clause to the agreement: we will enforce this in this and this court in London or Stockholm. That's completely, completely doable. On the other hand, I think what we need is improvement in Ukrainian judiciary system. And as I mentioned, it's completely realistic. What Timofey was talking about is completely realistic. Some of those guarantees will be provided, as Dmitro was talking about, by MIGA, by this member of World Bank Group. There'll be government guarantees. So I think it's rather a technical question, but it's completely resolvable. So I'm not really too worried about these issues. If there is a willingness to do that, that's doable. Now I would add one thing though: is accession to the EU means that you adopt a lot of EU law. So you actually rely on European Court of Justice on many things. And this was exactly why Brexit has happened, because British, 52% of British public decided they want to exit this dictatorship of this Luxembourg-based court. It's not economically, it's not been a great idea, but the idea of actually moving some of your judiciary sovereignty towards European Court of Justice is exactly what the EU accession implies, and that's great, and that works for members of the EU. That works for EFTA, for countries like Switzerland, Norway, who and Iceland, who use the Court of Justice of EFTA. This is what this process involves. So part of joining Europe is actually importing justice from Luxembourg. And 52% of British voters in 2016 thought it's a bad idea. But I'm pretty sure in this part of the world and in Ukraine, a lot of voters would actually think it's a great idea. And it will improve investment climate, and it will bring foreign investors, and it will reassure foreign investors.
Would you like to add something?
Would like to have an unpopular opinion. So... I think that in the case of the new EU member states actually delegating a bit of power outside of these countries has done them a lot of good. I mean, first of all, because it provided a commitment for the domestic politicians. Second, it also allowed the society to blame the EU for reforms and so on, and it's, you know, a win-win situation. So I mean, yeah, I mean, we, I'm sort of for these sort of arrangements. Yeah. Okay.
All right. So now we have a debate. Not quite on the issue of the Russian war in Ukraine, but on the issue of the role of outsourcing some of the institutions, and it's a little bit like. Bringing a teenager problem. If you let the teenager fully run independently, you know, there could be difficulties. But if you always babysit a child. It will never learn. So, but just to make it a debate, I will take a different position, although with the caveat that reality is complex. I think in part that's why all the IMF programs in Ukraine have been difficult. And they never finish. Because this idea that we can outsource things and it's a commitment mechanism, they work very well in theory, at least in Ukraine. But when it comes to actual implementation, there's still that problem that has not been resolved. So this outside commitment is not strong enough because you're not abandoning sovereignty. So you still can say, well, we're not going to do these reforms. Or we're not going to do something because something changed. Second, these institutions, the EU and the IFIs, they indeed, you know, ignore the good-bad economics-politics conflict. And I used to think that raising tariffs is a good idea according to the IMF plan. Until January 2021. That was the time where tariffs for distribution were liberalized, but some of the companies belonging to pro-Russian oligarchs actually increased themselves, the tariffs, by 42%. And publicly they ran a campaign that it was the government and the IMF which increased the tariffs, which was consistent with the memorandum, but the tale was that, you know, it was transmission versus distribution, and no one, and even probably us on the panel, will get confused about what's the difference. And which companies, you know, and it was not really the IMF or the Ukrainian decision. It was actually local. Medvedchuk owned companies, by the way, the guy who later was exchanged for Russia as a very high profile asset. And furthermore, because I was an advisor at the time in the office of the president, I saw the security services reports, intelligence report. They also organized the protests. So they themselves, as an economist, I was really shocked and appalled. But several years later, I'm like, okay, that's politics, okay? They basically raised prices, pissed off the local population, ran the local TV campaign that this is the government, and paid people, organizers, not people necessarily, to protest. And now I understand better every time the prime minister wants in Ukraine to raise tariffs, people who are more seasoned tell him this is going to be the end of you in the office. But I'm very glad we didn't change the prime minister the year before the war. Had he done those reforms and raised the tariffs, he would be out of the office. And maybe it's not a bad idea in principle when you do reforms. But in an isolated environment where there is no adversary. Had we changed the prime minister in the winter of 2021... we would have entered with fresh, rookie government in the war of 2022. And it could have gone the other way. It's really that important. So you can't take these things in isolation. The problem with institutions outside of, you know, any country is that they operate in some other aggregate content. But for the countries, you know, you have to be very careful about what you outsource and what you don't, because if you have adversaries, they will try to hijack these instruments. Furthermore, they often, and, you know, there is evidence on TV, run campaign that Ukraine is a failed state, that there is foreign governance in, you know, the IMF or, you know, Tucker Carlson yesterday, you know, I went, you know, he was, you know, parted somehow ways. I don't understand enough to comment on that, really. But I looked at his...
Fired. Yeah, you can say that.
Okay, so, you know, he was fired. But I looked at his Twitter. And on February 24, 2022, just hours before the war, actually 40 minutes before, he says, Ukraine is not a democracy. Ukraine is a State Department client state. So propaganda will use that, will hijack your outsourcing the sovereignty. So it's okay, I guess, temporarily to do it, but be very clear about what you do and why you do it.
So I'm cautioning against this idea that I'll say it in Russian, "За граница нам поможет." Yeah. So it's like that someone else will solve our problems. Okay. As we want to own the reconstruction, we have to own institution building. It's our job to build institutions. No one else can build institutions for us. Why? Because when things go sour, it's people who go to the streets risking their lives to defend those institutions. And if these are not the institutions we have built by them, then we can look at other examples where once the support was pulled out from the country's collapsed.
I fully agree. I mean, I've been observing some of the reforms and some of the projects, developments in many of countries in the region of Central and Eastern Europe. And what indeed is an issue is how to build the ownership of those changes within the country instead of, you know, just going from one project to another project run by another international institution. Because at the end of the day, if it is done like that, you have this teenager problem that cannot really deal with, you know, the challenges that are ahead. By the way, we have a very interesting program on our TV show that is called Teenagers Rule the Money. And I haven't seen either of the programs, but I do read sometimes that, you know, there's a teenager that buys a designer purse at the very first day of the month, and then at the end she, usually these are girls, doesn't have the money to pay the bills. So the issue is really how to build the ownership and how to develop. And I think the war, in a way, helped to show that there is structure and there is capacity within the institution. I once attended a meeting with Oksana Zabuszko, whom I love, and she's a great person. She's one of the best writers, I think, in Ukraine these days. And she said that, you know, once she received the prize for her book in the US, and someone said in the review that out of nowhere there's this amazing book. And she was really offended that it's not out of nowhere. You know, there's a certain tradition, a certain cultural development that led to what she wrote. So it's, I think, in a way, the war enabled the international institutions, but also the international world to see that it's not out of nowhere, that there's a nation that can stand for themselves. And you know, the issue is how to build.
Can I just say one thing? While the IFIs were evacuating, we were pushing payroll forward while evacuating. Mm-hmm. Our CFO, our accountants were pushing payroll forward on the first day of war so people had funding.
Yeah.
That's capacity. That's capacity. Capacity is not to evacuate.
Exactly.
The capacity is to push payroll while being bombed.
Fully agreed. I will now open to our audience. Do you have any questions, comments that you would like to pose? I still have two questions in front of me, but I think, I mean, before going to them, it would be good to hear from you if you have. Yes, please. There's a mic that goes to you because we need microphone for the YouTube.
First of all, thank you very much. And my question is to Timofey Milovan. Once again, what do you think? What we have to do with our justice? Not our Ukrainian justice.
Justice.
Because justice, yes. Because unfortunately, we have no another people. we cannot kill all our judges. But it's not a secret that this institute is the most corrupted institute in Ukraine. Very short.
Thank you. So I had notes, but the dynamics of the panel didn't bring me to those notes. I think it's a culture problem. And until we set up outside of the system law schools, which train new judges and prosecutors and detectives,
we won't be able to eradicate it. Because they learn on the job. And we have these people who we frisk out and train them, and sometimes people come there. But they're always in the minority. They have never gotten a critical mass to change the attitude, to change the social pressure. People respond to social pressure. People have this neurological tendency to harmonize with the behavior of others. It's emotional. I've been in all kinds of cultures, in the government and before, and I did sports, and I was an academia in the West, and I did business in Ukraine in the 90s. You harmonize with people around you, with the majority. You can withstand it to an extent, but you still drift towards what the status, you know, quo is. And if I take the example of the Kyiv School of Economics, the first two generations of economists like me had to leave the country. This is how bad it was. No government agencies, no ministers, nothing wanted us. And sometime in 2000s, actually around 2006, a year or two after 2004 revolution, people stopped wanting to go to do PhDs because they suddenly started getting a lot of attractive propositions inside the country, including in the National Bank, which has a lot of our graduates now, in the Ministry of Finance, Ministry of Economy. I'm not the first president of the Kyiv School of Economics who was a Minister of Economy. I'm second. So it has become, you know, we had people on the board who became Ministers of Finance. We have hired people who are deputy ministers or later became ministers, all kinds of people, you know. So, but it was not a norm. And we were in minority, and we had to leave the country. And then at some point, there were enough of us. We're still often in minority, but there is enough of people who are well-trained, who are educated, who can provide support network to each other and say, listen, that's okay. You are the normal one. The world is different. And so judges need that. And they don't have that. So fundamentally, I think three things have to happen for the judicial reform to change. We're running now judicial reform number 5 in the last 20 years in Ukraine. So one, there should be law schools that train new generations. Two, businesses and people have to understand what the courts are doing. Because these are the critical stakeholders. Until they take initiative, until, you know, these conversations I'm having with businesses saying, this is not my issue, this is political issue. But courts have not always been clean in Europe too, and in Britain, and in the US. And research shows that the businesses who got enough of being exploited by the politicians, they pushed back on the rule of law, on the property rights, on taxation, on everything through courts. So the social contract has to be there. If businesses are not interested in it, to the extent that they are willing, like people of Ukraine, pick up the arms, you know, do something. You know, people were interested in defending Ukraine. That's why Ukraine didn't fall. People took up arms. Do I see businesses going to protest against unjust courts? Not yet. So that has to happen. And every reform has a name. Prozora, National Bank of Ukraine, Naftogaz, you name everything, had a champion. All law enforcement reforms, judicial reforms, they are done in a very EU manner where it's a lot of bureaucratic directives. We change the law. There shouldn't be a champion. It should be the right law. That might be good for the system which works already, but not for the system which doesn't have the institutions yet. Where Dmytro was talking about the implementation, right? Where you change the law, but then legislation, the practice doesn't change. So in these environments, you actually have to have champions who both take leadership, inspire people, but also carry political responsibility for the result. As long as you can do reforms without carrying the responsibility for the result, without inspiring people to follow you, these reforms will fall empty. So I think three things have to be done. Leadership, bottom up, I'm rephrasing people. People have to understand. Reform a lower court so people understand what justice means. They don't understand what Supreme Court is doing. Whatever, and all the reforms in Ukraine have been done top down.
In theory, it's okay. In practice, people have no idea. I'm confused about how many top courts we have, high courts in Ukraine. And the third one is the culture, law schools. So I pitch, give us or someone else a lot of funds so we can set up, the way we have set up economic schools in Ukraine, we can set up law programs, okay? At least at the graduate level. Thank you.
Can I just add to this? I think I fully agree with what Timofey was saying. Judiciary reform is very unique because by definition we want a judiciary branch being independent. And so this is why in Ukraine we had this problem that Venice Commission, an international body, said, no, you cannot fire the judges. Judges have to be independent. And so the democratically elected president said, these are corrupt judges. I want to fire them. I need to fire them. People elected me to fire them. And this problem of independent branch is very pertinent in this country. In Israel now, when every weekend we have hundreds of thousands of Israeli citizens demonstrating, and President Trump was extremely unhappy about the independence of judiciary and tried to fire some judges. So this is a very interesting issue in a country where you start off with the judiciary reform, where you cannot actually replace the judges because it would break the independence principle, but you have to because judges are corrupt. And there, indeed, as Timofey has indicated, you need to have a critical mass of people you can install into judiciary branch. Luckily, over time, you have people who have been educated abroad, people who worked in the foreign law firms, Western law firms, people who work as corporate lawyers, people who teach abroad. So in principle, it's a much better situation today than 30 years ago. And that creates hope. And then you can install the critical mass of people at the top levels. And then also what you need to do, you also need to back it up with bottom up, probably at the bottom level where you elect local judges, where you can actually use local voters who know that this is an honest person and this person also has formal credentials. And that's something that can be done reasonably quickly today. Could be much more difficult 30 years ago, but today you have a critical mass of people. But in the long run, of course, building your own system of law schools is also important. And there you can also import law professors from abroad. And one other thing I would mention, there is again a case for optimism. Very many very corrupt countries have gone through this. We mentioned Bulgaria and Romania, which have been competing for the most corrupt country in the EU. They somehow function. They are European countries. They're still the most corrupt countries in the EU, but they're much less corrupt than they used to be, including in the judiciary. And in that sense, culture is important, but culture can change.
Yes, I think...
Sorry, just capture, mm-hmm. like abusing the power of not, you know... Okay. So I think also in Ukraine, people have forgotten that the courts are not that corrupt. In 2014, at the critical moment, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of Yushchenko being the president. So it actually protected the right of people to vote and elect their leaders. And I think that's what's critically different in Ukraine versus Russia. In Ukraine, people have learned over time that they can defend elections and defend their choice. And it might mean, you know, with life, but they still can. And the Supreme Court in Ukraine, as early as in 2004, played a critical role in that. So, yes, the system is problematic, but it is also in critical moments performs well. We have not seen any top court, high court, at critical moments over the last 30 years in Ukraine, ruling against the sovereign interests. We haven't seen that. No matter how corrupt some of the judges are. That's another reason for optimism. I mean, not that there's no issue, right?
Well, I must say that the leadership part resonated with me very well, because what we see is that the judicial system can be rotten from the top if we don't have good leaders. And we need to really continue. I mean, this is very important and I think crucial. Any other questions? We have two more, so I will ask for the two questions because we are running out of time and I know that Professor Guriev has to run. So those two questions, and I hope the power bank is still working. And another one, and I have two more here, and then I will do the final round.
Hi, my name is Julia. Despite being the master's student here at our alma mater, I'm also representative of the Student Association for the Recovery of Ukraine that we have here. We have also prepared a plan inspired beyond, among others, by the contributions of the Professor Milovanov and Professor Guriev to the CPR research. So thanks a lot. I invite you to take a look at our vision as of young Ukrainians that have experience both here and our Ukrainian background. However, my question is, we talk a lot about the human dignity and the value of the human life. We also speak a lot that the recovery process is first of all about the people. The people will be traumatized, the people will be tired, the people will be grieving for their loved ones, their lost children, they already are, and the pain will only be recurring more and more. The recovery process is very capital intensive, and the human capital is the central one. If we do not have the people to work, we will not really recover, right? Should Ukraine and its policy, in your opinion, give people the tools to work more, saying that, okay, now we have to recover, here is money for you, money for your children, or like the opportunity for children to get their education. You go to work, do your job, because we need recovery. Please do your best to recover because we need it now. We need the infrastructure, we need the hospitals, we need teachers teaching, we need professors at the universities. Or we refer somehow to the Scandinavian model where we say, okay, we understand that you are tired. Here is the money for you. Take a rest, leave the labor market for a part, and then you'll come back. But still keeping in mind that the money that will be given for the social coverage will be taken from the money for the recovery, also from the loans. So what should be the equilibrium here to solve this economics and human capital problem? Thank you.
Thank you. And another question.
Andrzej Nikolajczuk, SGH. My question is about Crimea. Crimea is a specific region of Ukraine, and should it be a specific policy toward Crimea after war? I mean, mostly from the social point of view, but also from the economic issue too. Thank you.
Okay, so one more question, and that will be the final one from the audience, and I have two more here.
Hi, I'm also from SKH, and my question is about can Ukraine really rely on international support to help them out of recovery? So we can see from observation right now that even President Zelensky has said that the support is slowing. And going forward, there are many geopolitical situations. In your opinion, do you think that Ukraine can rely on international support? And if they can't, what would be the best solution for funding?
Okay, thank you very much. So I have two more questions that I think are related to that. One is that Ukraine has been able to mobilize around 30 to 40 million of international support per year. How to increase... Billion, yes. How to increase these numbers? Are the Russian frozen international reserves the only option? And then also the one... would it make sense for to prepare a new Marshall Plan for Ukraine, but also three Eastern European countries, Ukraine first of all, but then also Moldova and Belarus? So these are the questions that are posed, and I'm sorry I have to close the questions part and go back to our panel with those in total five questions that were asked.
I'm going to go maybe first because some of the questions were sensitive and that will open, soften the discussion. So on Crimea,
Yeah, I think in practical terms, there should be a transition period. I mean, there is a question itself of Crimea, whether, you know, people have very different opinions. Ukraine will... I think what the world missed in 2014, if Russia can take Crimea, it can take Ukraine, try to take Ukraine. Ukraine said no to it and prepared over the 8 years. But I think the world has missed it. Everything they did in 2014 or in 2008, they used missiles in Georgia. So, you know, there's in some sense, we missed it, and there is nothing fundamentally new, just the scale is new. So we should be concerned about scale. Militarily, Crimea is unstable. It's like Kherson, where, you know, people went to Kherson, the Russian troops went to Kherson, and they had four bridges connecting them. So Crimea is connected by the Kerch Bridge, which is being threatened, challenged. And by the little strip of land, yeah, it's a land corridor, but Ukraine can challenge it even without additional territory. Where it is, it can challenge it. So in that sense, fundamentally, Crimea is going to be unstable. Regardless of geopolitics, it's not a stable outcome. So we will see a resolution one way or another in the next decade or two. It's just not going to be stable. It's just too tempting. It's like an unstable equilibrium outcome in game theory language. It's simply unstable. A little move can trigger dynamics. It's much more difficult, actually, to go land mile by mile in destroyed areas of the eastern Ukraine. Okay? Geography matters. So there will be a special period. And probably there should be a lot of international involvement. You know, my view would be some peacekeepers could be there, all kinds of things. We'll see how it is going to work out, you know. But I just want to open this issue that it's okay to discuss this issue and we have to be serious about it. Simple cavalier approach, or we're going to take it tomorrow back, or it's never going to come back. None of it is realistic, okay? It's simply the geography wouldn't allow and politics wouldn't allow. And on the other issues, on the recovery, I think people, both approaches are correct, because we currently have 17, before the war, million people in the labor force. We'll have 11 if we take the inertia scenario. So Ukraine has two post-war equilibria. One equilibrium was the brand is we are rebuilding, everything is happening, people are coming back. The other equilibrium is nothing is happening, you know, we're not coming back. That's the inertia scenario. That's going to be a very depressing outcome. So in that sense, you have to give people jobs, that there is business activity, you have to generate the brand that the country, and that attracts, you know, also answers the Marshall Plan. Yeah. Although we have written about the Marshall Plan, and that's a separate discussion, no time for this, but essentially I think it's important to generate that. But at the same time, with 11 million, you'll have a lot of people, especially elderly, who cannot work. So you will have to have social support. Going back to the support, you know, Ukraine, you know, it's a choice of the world in many ways. Ukraine has to be stable for the stability of security in Central Europe, not even East Central, even Western Europe and the rest of the world too. It is important. It's more important than most people tend to realize. How important it is that Ukraine is a stable democracy and doesn't fall into the realm of Russia in the next decade. Because if it happens, it will destabilize Europe. Not directly through Ukraine, but through the consequences which will happen after that in the next decade or two. All kinds of people will get encouraged within Russia. There will be winners, certain type. They will just push things. So Ukraine, therefore, will get this support, but it will not be easy. It will be as difficult as it has been with weapons. You know, everything is taught, everything that we ask for, we are told that is impossible until it is. The same will happen with the support. Nothing is possible until it is. But Ukraine has demonstrated that a lot of things are possible that we tend to think are not. So I think the same will happen with support. And also, Ukraine will have to spend about 20-30% of all of its budget, if not GDP, on defense in the foreseeable future. No country can grow without that much spending on defense, but we will have to.
because we have to match in principle what Russia will be spending on this threat. So therefore, Ukraine will rely on that type of support, or we will be seeing destabilization of the EU in the next couple of decades. So this, like, I am not even touching on China, Taiwan, and, you know, all kinds of consequences there. I think I have addressed almost every question. Now you guys can talk freely because I basically touched on every painful point.
Thank you very much, Sergei.
Yeah, let me talk freely. Crimea is not special. It was probably special before 2022, but after 2022, Western opinion has seen referenda in Kherson, Zaporizhia, and so on, and it's no doubt now that Crimea has the same status as Kherson. And as I mentioned, all Russian opposition is also united that Crimea is part of Ukraine and should be returned to Ukraine. And whatever terms Ukraine negotiates this return is a different question, but Ukraine should get back its borders in 1991. There is no anti-Putin Russian who is not agreeing with that. This is just publicly registered. Now, the other thing is, and I fully agree with Timofey, how that is structured is a different story, but maybe Crimea was special before full-scale invasion. That was not my opinion. I was publicly saying that Crimea is Ukraine. But for some people in the West, it was special. Some politicians in the West.
Special in time. If you look at pre-Crimea, that was a little bit different because of its history, maybe.
Yeah, history is different. But remember, in 1991, Crimea and Sevastopol voted in favor of Ukraine. This vote was the weakest vote, but it was in favor of Ukraine. So, on other questions on weakening Western support.
Sergei, yeah. Can I just maybe misunderstood? It's important because then it can be cut in pieces. So, Crimea is Ukraine. We all have an extremely strong opinion on this. What I was talking about structure, and I also have seen how propaganda works, even on me. That until 2004, until the Yushchenko poisoned, I kind of was buying some of the arguments. So propaganda is an effective tool. And yeah,
sorry,
we can go into this, but I think
a little bit for the sake of time.
But I think we forget, and when we're discussing Crimea, we're forgetting Crimean Tatars, and their view is also very clear. So in some sense, they have more legitimacy to speak. If we take that road, which I don't, but even if we were to take, so that's how you refute the propaganda, if you really take the road of who is there, whose land it is, and take it back to thousands of years, ask Crimean Tatars, and their view is very clear.
Yeah, on the weakening support from the West, we should remember why support is there, because public opinion is supporting Ukraine today. And I've heard this question from policymakers, experts in the West saying maybe this support will weaken, and we don't see that happening. Public opinion is still in favor of Ukraine because every month Putin commits new war crimes. And it's very clear that public opinion supporting Ukraine. If President Trump is elected, that may change. But mind you, the vast majority of Republican Party is in favor of Ukraine. And even DeSantis is now more in favor of Ukraine than he was. So that is something that we should all worry about. On Marshall Plan, I fully agree, and Timofey is correct, that we need a Marshall Plan. And remember, Marshall Plan after World War II was even extended to Germany, and U.S. Taxpayers paid for reconstruction of Germany because it was in the interest of the global liberal world order of which U.S. was a beneficiary. So this is a win-win game. To rebuild a large European economy is in the interest of European Union. As I said, Russia will pay for this eventually. But it's also in the interest of European Union to provide support for reconstruction of Ukraine, because this is good for European society to have a prosperous country next to Europe for a few years, and then a prosperous country within Europe when Ukraine joins the EU.
And for military reasons too, right? I mean, that's having strong Ukraine on our side in a way, it's a very important strategically. But also, I mean, if you think about Ukraine having the, you know, the level of income already before the war, even before, you know, the first part of the invasion, being you know, behind in a way several decades compared to the average in Europe, and then, you know, with the war and the drop of GDP by another 30%, right? I mean, that's this is a lot to rebuild. So, in fact, Ukraine need to get any help that it can get, and for as long as possible to be able to at least, you know, catch up, at least, you know, half of this over foreseeable future, right? I mean, this sort of income differences, infrastructure differences are not rebuilt overnight, right? So that's a major effort. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for this debate. We've extended a little bit our time, but I think we still managed to get people to places they need to be afterwards. I just wanted to say that at 6 p.m. we open an presentation of photographs from Chernihiv that will enable to for the people that couldn't be in Ukraine to see the extent of devastation. And if you are available, this is in another building, which is the C building on the corner of Aleje Niepodległości and Madalińskiego. If you have time, please go there. The photographs will be there for a while, so we and the building is open. So this is the first. The second, we've talked about propaganda and how people can be susceptible to propaganda, and I think that tomorrow's presentation of the book is very important in this respect. So I encourage you to come and think about, you know, how we can go under the spell of the spin dictators and how to avoid to be under the spell of the spin dictators. That is tomorrow. Thank you very much for being here. Thank you very much for a very wonderful debate, and I hope that some of the lessons will be carried on, and this is the beginning of, or the continuation actually of certain activities that will help us as to support, but also to you know, be a part of the process that is in Ukraine and is owned by the Ukrainian people on the recovery, on the development, on building the modern state that can emerge as phoenix from the ashes, if I may be so sort of colorful in the descriptions. Thanks very much again, and great applause to our participants. Thank you.
And thank you also for all users of internet. They were following our debates. There were as many as here in this room, so it's very, very good for us. Dmytro Bojarczuk, other distinguished guest, I would invite you to put your signature in our memory book for this event. Could you please just write some sentences and wishes for the SGH Warsaw School of Economics? It is a description of our event. Here is the place.